My name is Serena Kurka and I cordially welcome you into this podcast today, Neue Musik Leben. I have studied classical singing, but now I sing lots of contemporary and experimental music. And if you would like to know more about me, please look at my website www.irenekurka.de. I also cordially welcome you to subscribe to my monthly newsletter. In this podcast, I talk about all around themes around the new music world. I share with you the insights, the behind the scenes, and I really want you to bring the human beings out of this great world closer to you. And I hope to inspire you and even to empower you. And I thank you so much for all your great feedbacks that, tell me which direction to go, what do you really appreciate here, and also where I have touched and reached you or even motivated you to do certain things. I'm very, very thankful for all of that. I'm cooperating with the NMZ. That is the Neue Musik Zeitung, which is one of the most important German music papers, and you could also subscribe to it online. And yeah, I'm excited that there's so many great things going on, that this podcast is growing, that people listen to it really worldwide. I mean, we're coming into our seventh year, and if you would have told me that when I started, probably I would have not believed you, and somehow it grew so organic. I didn't do a lot. I just follow my impulses, my ideas, and suddenly we're here, and I'm really thankful for that. I'm also thankful that it happens that people listen to this podcast, and then they also go to my website or listen to tracks by me where I sing on YouTube or my website, and then they even contact me if they want to work with me. And the cool thing is, the people who have listened to this podcast and then contact me to work with me, it's usually a match, because I think you know me so well and you already know if I'm the person for you or not. And if you then reach out to me, it's usually really, really amazing. And so in a way, even though I'm here sitting by myself and speaking into the microphone, we're quite close. And I'm also very thankful that now for a few months already, I have voice students from all over. And it's possible with all this online technology. So I'm really excited. I'm excited to sing in Athens this year, in Luxembourg, in Graz, and all great cities in Germany. So maybe I see you at some place. And today I have a great guest for you. It is the composer and also gamelan player, Dieter Mack.
Hello, Dieter Mack. I cordially welcome you into my podcast today.
Hey, I'm very happy to be a member of this podcast group.
Thank you so much. And we have lots of great topics we want to talk about. But the first question I always want to know from any of my guests, and I'm really curious about that, is how did you find your way into this new and experimental music?
Oh, that's a long story. I think I must go back to my teens. That means I was first not interested in music at all. I was much more into sports, especially gymnastics. I had learned piano, as everyone did at that time, if there was piano in the house, but that was not my favorite occupation. And then I got illness during the sport with my spine, and I had to stop sports completely. And then, I was starting to think, what can I do? And then I had some friends in a youth group, and we made a so-called skiffle band, if you know what that is. A skiffle band is where you use everyday tools, you use pots for percussion instruments, and you take a nylon stripe and for a bass, and you take is a kind of washing board for and one acoustic guitar, and we made music like that. And it was quite fun. And then, in fact, I really, because we discussed it just before, I really started my first rock band as a drummer. And how old was I? 15, 16? 15, I think, yeah. And from the very beginning, we tried, besides covering some songs, we tried to write our own music. And in the end, that came always to me. I don't know why. But then after, let's say, a year, I felt, why shall I waste my time for playing the drums? If I have an education in classical piano, I should move to the keyboards. And then I moved to the keyboards, and then actually the real work started. And in the early 70s, we had two bands, but the same people. The one band was for dance music to get the money, and the other one was our experimental rock jazz group to make really the music we want to do. And especially for the second one, this was my responsibility, and I started to compose the pieces that we played. And if you go in this direction, my idols were at that time Emerson, Lake and Palmer as a keyboarder, or Pink Floyd, and especially the German psychedelic music scene like Popol Vuh, Tangerine Dream, Embryo, and all these guys. And I had also one of the first Moog synthesizers in Germany, actually. So I was very early into electronics at that time. And if you do that, you are very close already to the experimental electronic music scene of so-called contemporary music. And I really can't say when it switched from the one side to the other. In a way, it was a continuous move from the one side to the other. And I remember there was one crucial event. At that time, the Nationaltheater Mannheim had a very big reputation for modern dance. And there was a performance of the Netherlands Dance Theater with the choreography by Hans van Manen. And he made choreographies to the Telemusik from Karl-Heinz Stockhausen, a complete electronic piece from 1966, and to the Banquet Céleste, one of the early organ pieces by Olivier Messiaen. And this was, for me, a new world, and I had a very strong influence on my own thinking. And then I really switched more and more into this electronic world. And then I visited, I tried to find out where electronic music is made, and I got in contact with this experimental studio of the Heinrich Strobel Stiftung in the Südwestfunk, which was in Freiburg, still is in Freiburg. And they had just been established, and they made courses for composers. And even I was not yet the real composer, I just applied. Yeah? And they invited me. It was quite funny, because I knew much more about electronic music than the already reputed composers, but I had no idea about composing. Yeah, so it was a very nice combination. Yeah, and that's how it started. And then this was also the reason that I came to Freiburg for studying, because of the studio. And so it means my first musical works were mostly electronic pieces up to 1978, when it stopped at once.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So then when you were in Freiburg, after you got accepted to the electronic studio, you also then applied for the Hochschule there?
Yes.
Or?
Yes.
Yeah, so you
applied to
did
the Hochschule.
Proper study.
Right. So that the work in the electronic studio was just like a kind of assistant. At the beginning, got some small jobs, and finally I got a real contract with a monthly salary, 300 mark. It's not very much at that time. For a student, it was quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? And But I did my formal studies at the same time, parallel, at the Musikhochschule in Freiburg in composition theory, music theory, and piano. So that's it.
And you just mentioned there was a time that you stopped doing electronic music, right? Yes.
Yeah, but that happened in 78. I studied from 75 until 18. And in 78, I had my first visit to Bali. And this Balinese music experience turned me upside down, so to speak. And I said I have to start from scratch again with everything in my musical thinking, in my philosophy of life, et cetera, et cetera. And then I felt electronic was nothing interesting for me anymore.
Well, how did you get to Bali?
With a plane.
But somebody invited you, or?
No. Yeah, in a way, it was like that. There was a funny experience during my studies. My composition teachers were Klaus Huber and Brian Ferneyhough. And I was mostly together with Brian Ferneyhough, actually. And he had a quite international class, people from Canada, USA, Japan, Sweden, Norway, and German. And one day he said, it could be interesting for the class if everyone gives a kind of talk in the seminar on his or her respective musical background or culture, not knowing or not recalling at that moment that his Japanese student did not know anything about traditional Japanese music because he was Western educated. Yeah. So when he was aware that this idea was almost to fail, then he said, okay, if it's like that, I give you some things to do. You must take care of another. He was never interested in other musical cultures, by the way. So I still don't know why he motivated us to do so. And I asked him years later, why did you do that? Don't ask me. I can't tell you. So, and then I said, Dieter, would you be interested to make a paper on Balinese gamelan music? I have never heard any sound at that time. And I said, yeah, okay, why not? I said, okay, I have a friend. He's the ordinarius for musicology in Basel, Professor Dr. Hans Oesch, and he's also specialized on Bali. I will give him a note and you go to him and he will help you. At that time, as there was only one record from the Deutsche Grammophon, a three-record set on Balinese gamelan from Gongse Batu. I bought that.
This wow, really? One CD? That's...
At that time, was one... No CD. Vinyl.
Oh, LP, yeah.
Yeah. We are in the late 70s.
Yeah, right.
And I bought that, and you didn't understand anything. And then in Basel, it was even worse. They were very nice, the people there, but they were specialized on a very, I call it, esoteric ritual music style from Eastern Bali, which is, in a way, even today, not representative for Balinese gamelan, that's what we know today. And so I got this information, but I thought this is the Balinese gamelan music, what they gave me. But it was just this ritual music from Eastern Bali and the mountain area. It also didn't appeal to me, but I made my paper and my presentation, and so this was finished. Weeks later, and I can't say why, all of a sudden I felt, I'm curious. In fact, I would like to know what's going on there. Then I just went to travel agency, Reisebüro, and I said, sorry, I would like to go to fly to Bali. How much does this cost and how does it work? Oh, it's very interesting, not complicated. But finally, I bought my ticket. My parents were going crazy, but I didn't care. And then I got a contact address from these Basel people in the capital from Bali, And then I flew there and I went to this guy, and this guy then brought me into a village. And then what happened there in the next 2 months was so exciting for me that, as I said at the beginning, it turned my whole life upside down. So,
was this your first time abroad?
My first time abroad alone, yeah. Wow. I was two times with my parents on holidays in Sweden, in France. But in a way, yeah, it was the first time abroad.
And it must be also a shock because, I mean, I've never been to Bali yet, but I mean, it must be such a different culture than anything in Europe or
yeah.
The food, even, everything.
Even at that time, I mean, there was this, it's already the beginnings of this tourist atmosphere at the beach, but that's, I was not interested in that. Yeah? So the village where I was staying, there was no electricity. There was no street. In fact, it was a footpath, and after 1 hour rain, you were closed up in the village. And also no communications, no cars, nothing. It was just very pure in the nature. And in the first moment, this was extremely exciting for me. But after 3-4 days, it turned around something other, because I was alone. I didn't have anyone to talk with about my experiences, and I still couldn't speak the language. Yeah? I thought I had a kind of dictionary which I bought that it will easily work, but no, it did not. Yeah. So in the very first, I could hardly communicate with the people and had nobody to communicate at all. And that became a mental problem. And so it happened that one night I was really running through the village, crying very loud, and then going back again in my place. I was in a small hut in the middle of a lake, which I had prepared for me. And next day, okay, it was fine. Yeah, and it was very interesting that the Balinese, they didn't care. They
really okay. Yeah,
they didn't care. The only next thing, good, everything fine. So, and years
later, I cannot even imagine how it is, like you said, that you cannot really communicate. I mean, I went to study abroad in the United States, which is English, but yeah. It was also interesting because at that time my English was really terrible. They mm-hmm. also told me when I got to the university in the United States, you get an advisor, and she was really concerned that I even would make it. and so in the beginning, and that was good and bad at both times, because I was in Dallas, Texas, there was no one I could talk German to. So the good thing was I had to learn really English. And the bad thing was my head was like smoking, because it was like working to kind of get through. But it was also, I think, the best and the fast way to learn this language, because after a few months, I was really good. And I also passed my first term. And then they even asked me then if I would teach other foreign students in English. But it was just the force. That was the only way yeah. to go. But I also remember that sometimes, like, I wish I could talk to someone. Sure.
Yeah, but
and even though I was not lonely, because there were students and I, you know, I was in a crowd and I tried my best, but sometimes I also just, because there were so many words missing, and then I would describe it and whatever, say, oh, it's furry and does meow. And then they would say, oh, you mean a cat. So this is how I would learn the language. Mm-hmm. And eventually, well, now we're talking in English and I'm fine, but your experience must be much more challenging. But how did the music come into that? Did that soothe you somehow, or make connections with people?
Let me just finish that story. Yeah.
Okay.
After this running around in the night and then no reactions from the Balinese, then years later, when we were close friends, I asked my family, hey, why did you not react at that time when I went crazy in the night? And then they started to laugh. They say, why are you laughing? Tell me. You see, the place where we put you to stay, to sleep, is a place which is very famous in the village for black magic. And we thought the Westerners don't believe in that and they can't be affected by the black magic. But you got infected as well. And we really liked that. We felt, hey, he's like us. Yeah. And then it was quite normal for them, yeah? Because they thought it was the influence of black magic. That's it. Yeah, language problem. It was even worse in Bali because I needed quite a long time to be aware that I have to learn two languages. Because there was the Bahasa Indonesia, the national language, and the local language, the Balinese language. And they were mixing up that as well. And it was very difficult for me to separate the one language from the other. So I needed much more time and throughout the next year. So when I went back, I started to learn and to separate those languages. So in the beginning, it was difficult. Yeah? Mm. So music. I came into this village especially because it was well known for gamelan music and dance. And this guy who brought me there from the capital, he spoke with the family, you can stay here. And then they put already some instruments, and then the old man, the boss of the family, was sitting, started to play. I should do the same as he does. So then I started to imitate. So it went on every day, 4 or 5 hours. He played something, I imitated him, and started again from the beginning. So I didn't know what I was learning, actually. Today I know. And the funny thing was, then after 2 weeks, I was waiting to hear the real gamelan orchestra. After 2 weeks, he said, he explained me, I don't know in which words, that in the evening there will be rehearsal of the gamelan. And they will play, as at first, they will practice the piece I just had learned. Yeah. Oh, great, fantastic. And came the rehearsal in the evening, they started to play. I was deeply disappointed, because I didn't find any connection between what I heard in the gamelan group and compared with that what I have learned. Today I know why. Yeah? But at that time it was deeply disappointing for me, because I didn't understand, what did he teach me? Yeah? They play something completely different. And then they played 3 other pieces, and I thought they play all with the same piece. So it was the extreme case that if you hear something new, you hear only first these things that are already known by yourself. Yeah? Mm-hmm. That could be something completely different, like the Balinese hear themselves in their music. And years later, when they played this piece, I need 3 pitches, I knew which piece it is. Yeah. So it was just the problem that I was not familiar with that, and also what teaching and learning means in this case, that he taught me something which is, let's say, kind of hidden melody which goes through the piece, which you not really hear as a main melody, but which is the core of the whole piece. So it was a really long process of getting into this world of music. In a way,
you were there 2 months and you started to get into that, and then you went back. And when did you feel that you got a more real sense of this music? Oh. How long does it take?
Okay, I was there 2 months in 78. I went back to Germany and I had to continue my studies. But my whole mind was completely somewhere else. And the thing I was thinking of was to find the money to go there again. And then I went there a year later again for 2 months. And then a year later again for 2 months. And then I was at a point where I started to understand more. But then I decided that after my studies, I want to go there for a whole year. And I would say after this whole year, I was at a point that I had a decent understanding of that music. Mm-hmm. So that was in 82 then. Yeah.
Okay. And then how did it change your composing while you started going to Bali, or what happened with your composing style?
Yeah, this is, people often think this that this music has influenced my music. I would say no, except the fact that I completely went away from electronics, that I went to instrumental pieces, and that it was very clear from the very beginning, the more I knew about that music, the more I wasn't interested that that plays a role in my compositions. But what would happen in the unconscious is something else. But this aspect in the unconscious had less to do with the musical language itself, but more with the way of playing, the way of performance, this kind of collective playing. And I started to find concepts in my music where this kind of collective playing could be realized. And there is, so the influence is much more in this kind of playing attitude and less in the musical language itself, except that I'm interested in metal sounds since then. Yeah, but this is a very superficial aspect. You have also metal sounds in Western music. You need not go to Bali for that.
Yeah. And you already played in your Skittle band. There you also had metal sounds.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. So, apparently, I was a heavy metal person. heavy metal was not yet on the scene.
And you discovered all this great music in Bali with the gamelan. Did you also go to other places then in Southeast Asia? Did you got to know more about this area?
No, not at that time. I was shortly for 2 months also in South India. A friend of mine was studying flute there, as in South Indian flute, and he said, "Come by, you can learn a little mrindangam." But it was very important that I did that because I felt okay. Balinese gamelan is a very complex music culture and culture itself. South India is a very complex culture and music itself. I can't get into both at the same time. This is too big. Yeah. And then I said, I had to do this slight experience to know, no, I focus on the gamelan. And so that means after that short visit to Madras, I did never go anywhere except to Bali for the next 10 years. Yeah. And the first trip outside Bali was then in 88, but that's another story then. So
and then you were also interested to bring this music or also the gamelan music to Germany?
Yeah. In after this 1 year stay, I bought a whole gamelan set and brought it to Germany and started the gamelan group here in Freiburg, which was very exciting because there were some people who were really interested. The problem was we were never enough to play in a whole orchestra because the whole orchestra needs 25, 27 people. But just by chance, we were contacted by the second group in Germany who played Balinese gamelan. This was in Munich. And they had some problems in the group, and they had heard from us, and they wanted to know how we deal with these social problems within the group. And then we came in contact, and they had the same problems regarding the amount of people. And then we decided that we should work together. That means from that on, which was in 85, I would say, yeah, in 85, all concerts we did with the best people from both groups. This was, we call that our all-star band. And one time it was on the name of the Munich group. One time it was on the name of the Freiburg group, but it was always the same people. Yeah, we didn't. That was very good. We didn't care about. There were no animosities between us. We just worked together. We knew that in Holland, for example, where the Balinese groups they fight each other because everyone wants to be the number one. We didn't care about that. We just brought it together to make the music as good as possible.
And was the audience curious in hearing gamelan music?
Very different. Yeah, the audience was generally quite curious. Yeah, but there was a time in the 80s where the interest was much more in more esoteric aspects, where a lot of people from the New Age field. Is this the moon tone of the gong or the sun tone of the gong? Sometimes I said yes, just to have, not to continue. Sometimes I said sorry, you know, Balinese have different concepts. Yeah, must disappoint you. Yeah, they were just excited about how it worked because we were aware after some concerts that if we just play, they think there are some Westerners who really can't, because they didn't understand. And then it was our fault, yeah? Because we played it in that way. And then I started to play 2-3 pieces, and then I explained the structure of the music with some examples. And that was very helpful. Then the perception of the people changed very quickly. They didn't understand it, not 100%. Yeah, but there was another kind of awareness of that, what we did. They became aware that quote, probably not so wrong what we do, yeah, something like that. And there was only always one very complicated point in our group that was the appearance, the clothes. We were in the group always 100% convinced we play in a uniform dressing, black t-shirt and trousers, okay. But when we played for Indonesians, they wanted us to play in Balinese traditional clothes. And there was an endless discussion over 20 years how to present ourselves in public. And there were some people in the group who said they leave the group when they have to wear these clothes. Yeah, this is exotism. And I could completely understand that. Yeah. Then I said, could we, you know, we do something for the Indonesians. And if they are happy with it, then let's do like that. If we don't play for others, then we play normal in our uniform, black t-shirts. And finally, it was working in that way, but it was always an ongoing discussion. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And when you now look back, I mean, when you went there, I mean, it really sounds adventurous. You just took a plane to a country that you had no clue about.
Yeah.
And I mean, those were the times without internet, whatever, right. iPhones and all that.
Yeah.
And you went there and, I mean, what if you wrote letters or maybe sometimes had an expensive phone call or so on. And now we are having whatever internet, we're having social media. Do you feel now we're somehow more connected or do we know more what's going on? Or does it still feel like two separate continents or what has changed?
Yeah, it's a good question, which it's also difficult to answer. I feel that we know not more than in the other, than in the earlier times, because in the earlier times, if you really want to have to know something, and you had to go there in this intensive way, as I did, I learned much more, like just going in the internet, giving in Bali, and see what is coming. Yeah, so. I am convinced that the life experience, the personal experience, the personal exposure to something, and with all the good and the bad aspects, yeah, is much more rewarding in the end than the total availability in the internet. And it was also interesting. You see, at that time, it was easier for me to find some aficionados who would like to learn that music. Today is much difficult. It's not possible at the moment, again, here in this area, and also by my friends in Munich, to find people anymore who want to invest such energy and time to play that music. That was different in the 80s, when you really had to go there. And all our gamelan members had been in Bali, certainly, to experience that. So I don't think that the availability today gives us a better understanding of the other world. It's okay. It's helpful if you have this personal experience. Then I can use the internet in another way. For example, when I'm together in Bali now with my close friend, Deva Alit, one of the most interesting composers there, and we discuss about composing and music, and I'm joining the rehearsals and his concerts, and then I come home and listen to his new pieces on the internet. Something completely different. Yeah. Then I feel like for a moment I'm sitting in his orchestra and listen to his music.
That's interesting. There's nothing about the real experience.
Yeah.
And going to a concert or really practicing or learning an instrument or whatever it is. Yeah, I mean, that's just, and I think even if you have now all this electronic possibilities and AI and so on, you can never substitute that, I think. I mean, we don't know, but.
I think so too. We have that, and we should more think about where these gadgets are useful, how can we use them in a controlled way? We see already in the political scene, like on this platform X now, how political influence is made with these mediums. And this is for me something which makes me a little nervous, I must say.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. And do you still play gamelan?
Yeah, a little. I must say it's... I have my own instruments I have given to a group in Leipzig, because I have no place here in Freiburg to store the instruments. But my problem is something completely different. I can't sit anymore on the floor because of my legs. And it's the same with my friend, who the leader of the Munich Gamelan. We are both 70 years old now, and... we can play still the instruments where we can sit on a chair. There are three instruments where you can sit on a chair that we can do. Yeah, but we have both stopped to practice, and the only really practicing group in Mont is this group in Leipzig. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But they are in their 30s, 40s, as we have been 20 years ago. Yeah.
And you also have been teaching composition for a really long time, I think in Lübeck, right?
Yeah.
And what kind of people came then to you? I mean, were they also not just interested, whatever, in composing, but also in gamelan music? Or what people came to you to study?
Very mixed, very mixed. At that time, I have already been quite a lot around the world in many other countries. If you give a workshop in China, you can expect that in the next entry exam, you have 10 Chinese students who want to study with you. No? I really always had to find a middle way that was my philosophy. 50% German students, 50% from other countries. Yeah? And not because I'm a racist or I'm a nationalist or whatever, I thought this is necessary to have a good mixture. If I would have, and I know some colleagues who have, he has a class, I think the 90% Koreans, yeah? I would go mad with that. Yeah? I know why it is like that. He has been there in Korea and has made many courses, and he's a great composer. But such a monocultural class would be completely impossible for me. So I really tried to have 50% Germans, which is also a language problem. A lot of Asian students, they have a problem with language. Yeah? And I think there is no other subject at the music university that needs language more than composition. Yeah? Because with the instrument, if you study piano, the teacher can show you on the piano. But if you composition, you have to speak, you have to talk. And so it was always, I was always happy when I got an Indonesian student that I could speak Indonesian with him. And the problem was solved, or that Malaysia. That was always good. But Chinese and Korean students sometimes really made me mad. Yeah. Japanese normally were very good in German. And also from Colombia, Argentina, the Southeast, people from countries with Latin language. Yeah, that was always easy. That was not the problem. But the biggest problem was with Chinese and Korean. And there were also some who spoke fluent, but there was also the extreme opposite. Yeah? And that's why I initiated very many activities in the class where they have to work together, just to not to get into the culture. Yeah. So when they come to Germany, they also should experience how German culture works, whether they like it or not, I don't care. Yeah? But they shall experience that. And fortunately, most of my German students, they really did a lot of efforts to integrate these foreign students into their cultural realm, that they learn and also improve in language. Then that was very obvious. Yeah. And that worked quite well over these almost 20 years that I was teaching composition in Lübeck. Sometimes it was a little more like that, sometimes a little more like that. But basically, I could keep this kind of ideology in structuring my class.
Yeah. I mean, you have experienced so much and already you can look back at so much. But I'm also always curious, is there anything you learned about how to structure a day? Maybe it changed now because you're not in university anymore. Are you more a structured person or are you, I don't know, going with the flow? Or did you have certain routines that you composed, I don't know, every morning or something like that?
You mean now?
Maybe both. Maybe it's also interesting to look at both. Anything changed?
I think no, it had nothing changed. The one thing has changed. But the time of composing is always, I have no special time, but I have to define my composing time period, which during the semester was only in semester holidays, yeah, or sometimes that I really just dropped 1 week and went back into a retreat and worked. And so at the moment it's the same. If I want to compose, I go into a, how do you call that? Ferienwohnung. It's a kind of small
apartment or something. Yeah,
yeah, small apartment in the mountains.
Oh, nice!
And that's then my composing time. That means I have also, if I accept commissions, I have to always to consider, when do I have the time to do it or not? And if as you feel I have not the time, then I say, sorry, at the moment, this is not possible. No. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, I need a free space. I can't, for example, say, okay, today I'm teaching until 4, then I go home, then I have dinner for an hour, and then I compose for 2 hours. It's impossible. Yeah, because composing for me, I must be completely on my own, and it may happen that 3 days I don't write a note, and I only walk around or clean the room, do anything, just until it's all of a sudden I can start. Yeah, and this is always like that, I can only organize the temporal frame in which that has to happen. Fortunately, so far, it has always worked. But the difference at the moment is, and this makes me a little nervous sometimes, since I have finished teaching, since I'm retired, the speed of my composing has declined extremely. Mm. That means I need much more time for composing a piece than I did before. And in the first, I was a little nervous and I thought, why is it like that? Shall I see that positively or negatively? In the first, I saw it negatively. Yeah? And then I tried after a while when that happened with some compositions, is there a difference in my composing? Yes, it's a slightly difference, but not something that I would say have changed in a negative way. But still, I was thinking, why did that happen? And then I became aware that it's apparently this daily discourse with students and teachers on compositional problems always triggers your own creativity. Mm-hmm. And if that is not happening anymore, yeah, you need longer to trigger yourself for your own creativity. And I think this is the reason. It's interesting, that's what my friends tell me. When I'm now, very last Saturday, I had 3 very good musicians here as a guest. And they tell me then that I really start to talk like a waterfall. Yeah. And because they weren't used that I do that. Yeah. And then I became also aware that there was again this university situation. Yeah, this kind of discourse with these 3 friends who were visiting me. So, yeah, that means I composed.
I also wonder if it's a different feeling for time, because when you were at university, I mean, you had a structure, and as you said, you composed in the breaks, but you always had a structure, and maybe, I don't know, now you have less structure, more freedom, and
no.
Maybe it takes more time, no?
No. That has a little to do with my way of working in the university. I was completely unstructured. Yeah? Okay. I had some regular events like my seminar and my gamelan group, but these were the only constant events. All the other things were completely changing because, you see, one time, formally, each student had the right of 90 minutes individual class per week. But that's impossible because there is a student, he is writing an orchestra piece. He needs 3 weeks on his or her own. Yeah? And then maybe in 1 week I'm meeting him or her 5 times, yeah, after that. So he was completely unstructured. And besides, I was 8 years of that whole time. I was also in the presidency of the. I was vice president of the Musikhochschule Lübeck, and in this function, I had to go there, had to go there, had to go there. Then I was in the DAAD selection committee, then in the Goethe Institute advisory board. So there were so many things which always impeded to have a regular. Work. It's even more regular now. Yeah? And I'm not very happy about that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Interesting.
I think this kind of irregularity in work also once again triggers creativity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have the feeling I know both. Sometimes it's like when I know also before we started our interview, I knew I had whatever an hour to do something and I was like really eager to do it and I got it done. And sometimes I like that to know, okay, I just have this hour. And then sometimes it makes me tight and then I don't start a certain work and I say, no, I will do it when I have whatever 4 or 5 hours or so of free time. And it's always changing. Yeah, it's interesting. And when you look at your life, or also, I mean, you accompanied so many students, what do you think is important that you live this path or this path of a composer, authentic and true, that you do really what fits to you? How did you help your students?
I helped my students in that way that when they started to imitate me and I sent them home. I was very radical when I felt he's imitating me, go home. Yeah. That's not why you are here. You should find your own way to do. And even if you would finally decide not to become a professional composer, that's fine for me. Four of my, I would say my four best students, they have completely different professions. One is now the concert dramaturgy at the Staatstheater in Karlsruhe. One is at the criminal police in Wiesbaden.
Wow.
One is, I only know the German word, but maybe you know the English, Fluglotse.
Okay, it's the airport, air traffic, but it's the person that is on the ground with maybe showing how the plane goes. Yeah, I don't know the word.
Air traffic controller.
Yeah, you know the word, good.
Yeah.
Wow.
And which is really an extreme responsible job. Yeah. But he's a great guy. And I remember he was one of my best composers and winning a lot of prizes. And one day he came to me and said, hey, that's not my job. I have applied to become an air traffic controller. And then from 800 applicants, they choose 8, and he was one of these 8. Yeah. And now he's working in Karlsruhe in the air traffic control for southern Germany. And when I asked him, why did you do that? He said, you know, in this job, I have to work 3 days a week altogether. Yeah. So I have a lot of free time. I earn very good money. He has now his starting salary at the moment is higher than my ending salary at the university. Yeah? And then I have a lot of money. I need not care about money. And I can compose what I want.
Awesome. Yeah,
I can understand that decision. Yeah? I can completely understand that. Yeah? And so it was for me much more important. Okay, there was this whole craftsmanship as a composer. Yeah? They had to learn techniques, know the instruments, and there's very basic stuff. Yeah? And this is completely non-individual. This is for everyone. But then you have this individual person. And the interesting thing for me was to see how the individuality, the personality changed over the 3, 4 years, 5 years they have been working with you. Yeah? And that could go in completely different directions, finally. Yeah? And there are only four. No, let me see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There are 8 students from which I know that they are professional composers or also already teaching composition now. Yeah? There are a lot of students I have no contact anymore. They need not. Yeah? I don't force anyone having contact with me. That means what I want to say is I was more interested to influence the development of a personality. Yeah? And if this development of a personality finally led to something outside the music, yeah, okay, why not? Then he can have the music still as his hobby. Yeah. And so that means that, in other words, we had a lot of discussions about life philosophy, thinking what is important, and sometimes hours long, where we didn't speak about music, yeah, but about what can be the target of your life. Yeah.
And that's even in a way more important. But I often realize now, since I'm doing this podcast and I'm talking to composer teachers, professors like you, and when you talk about how you taught or how composition classes were, I'm often very jealous, because I mean, I studied voice, and in my times, I think it changed a little depending on the teacher. My teacher was only concerned with my voice. Mm. Anything else, what was about me or what I was concerned with or whatever, frightened of or something, she did not really care. My voice had to function. I had to sing beautifully, and that was all that mattered. And I sometimes wished I had someone like this composition professor who maybe would have helped me in all these other areas.
Yeah, I think this is, I would agree with you that most instrumental teachers just are concerned about your instrument, and that's it. Maybe this is something also which was triggered by my Balinese experience. Yeah, that this kind of socialization of yourself was such a very interesting process over there, that I was much more interested in the development of the person itself. Yeah? And there are so many factors outside of the music which play an important role. Yeah? And I remember, just for example, a Chinese student who was so under pressure by her parents that she was sitting there crying helplessly. Yeah. So what will you do then? So you go home and look that you get along with your parents? No. In that moment, I was her father in a way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was that for quite a long time then, yeah? Until she found kind of stability in her own behavior. Yeah? And that didn't happen only one time. We should not forget that people coming from from other countries, they have completely different cultural backgrounds. I had an Iranian student whom I taught 2 years online because he didn't get a visa. Yeah. Mm. So then when he was really allowed to leave the country with very many difficulties, and I must say with some vitamin B by myself, because I have good connections to the foreign department, and then I knew that he had completely complicated background in that country. Yeah, and for him this was now like coming out of a prison into a free world. Yeah, and but he also saw it's a free world, but also not such an easy world. So, but these are things which you have to deal with as a teacher. That's at least my opinion. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, yeah. But I also think, I only went to the United States, but it also changed so much for me, because I think whenever you leave your country or your culture, you learn so much, so many new things about yourself. Or even when you then come back, or when we came back to Germany, things were so differently. Or I also, whatever, appreciated some things more that before were just there. like when you go to the United States, I mean, the thing is, there is no real old architecture, which sounds maybe weird, but that was one thing I was missing a lot. Because, I mean, they built churches, but they're new, and they built them after European models. And so when I left, or I also had to leave because my degree was done, I really was looking for old buildings. And it was good that I first went back to Nuremberg, where I grew up, because it's a medieval town. And I had these old rocks and those old churches and an old wall and so on. And I really loved it because we have this rooting here in Europe, because we have old stuff, we have old history. And I mean, the history of the United States is very different. And so I find that very, very important. And I'm glad that, I mean, especially in the music world, we often travel and go to places. And this is such a big gift to experience so much more.
Yeah, I see that. I also feel I'm very privileged with that, what I was allowed to do in my life. Even with the negative aspects, which belong to this as well. Yeah? My contacts with Indonesia, for example, were not always very pleasing. Yeah? This was a military dictatorship in the 80s, 70s, 80s. And that was not so easy sometimes. But this belongs also to my life experience. But it's a good point that you say in the US that they have this lack of history, which in a way makes things easier for them, especially in arts. For example, as a German composer, you always feel the burden of your history, which you... And my teacher, Freiburg, was a center for that, as a composer, you are responsible in the dialectic process to your history. For an American composer, he would laugh like crazy if I tell him that. Yeah? I once had a discussion about that with Philip Korner, and he said, why do you do that? You need not. Yeah? You are a free artist. Yeah? And but as I said, we have that history, and it's always present. Yeah? I cannot push it away. Basically, I have also no problem with it. Yeah? Mm-hmm. It does not impede my own position. If I feel that I decide to do things like that, and I need not put them in relation to the history, I need not. Nobody pushes me in that way. But for me, this is something which works more in my unconsciousness. So, but I know that there are composition teachers there were composition teachers. Today, it's not anymore like that. But in my time, where this kind of historicism was very important.
Yeah? I know. And I also know there were composers, I'm not going to say any names, but I know students of them, where there was those times where whatever, if you would, you were not allowed to compose like an octave or certain intervals. It was like a taboo, don't do that because this is not avant-garde or something like that. And now there is much more freedom and variety, which I also enjoy a lot. Yeah. And thank you so much for this great talk, Dieter. And I have the last question for you. And my last question is, which tip would you like to give young artists?
Be always honest to yourself. That's it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure talking to you, and I see you around.
Okay. Thank you.
This was the interview from today. I hope that it inspired you. And please send me your emails, send me your feedback, because I love to interact with you. Thank you very much that you tuned in with me today. I really, really hope that you liked it. And please tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. I thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.